The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Allies are also supporting and stepping up humanitarian aid and financial support. We discussed what more we will do, including cybersecurity assistance and providing equipment to help Ukraine protect against chemical and biological threats.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
John Stoltenberg from NATO earlier today, and well, appropriate as I want to take a look at a topic that you may not have given a lot of contemplation to. In just a moment, John O'Neill, who's the author of the New York Times bestseller Unfit for Command, has come out with a new book called The Dancer and the Devil. And I was reading a little bit of this earlier today in preparation, and it says, communism must kill what it cannot control. For a century, it has killed artists, writers, musicians, even dancers. It kills them secretly using bioweapons and poison to escape accountability. Amongst its victims was Anna Pavlova, history's greatest dancer, and who was said to have God-given wings and feet that never touched the ground, but she defied Stalin, and for that she had to die. Her sudden death in Paris in 1931 was a mystery until now. Of course, goes through a lot of other issues as well. John traces Marxism's century-long fascination with bioweapons from, you know, the Soviet leak in 1939 all the way up through the 20th century. And he joins me today. He looks at everything from Wuhan, China, and COVID-19 to Putin and Xi as being perpetrators of vast crimes against humanity themselves. I thought this was well worth talking about. Hey, it's good to have you with me today, John. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Drew. I particularly enjoy being on your show.
Thank you. I received your book the other day, or at least it was going through. I find this fascinating. I mean, I really do so much. I know I just broad-brushed a lot of what's going on here, but maybe you can give everyone who's listening a better understanding. Let's talk about why you decided to write this book, especially on Stalin and Putin and Xi. And I think history is very important to look at current situations, and there's been a lot of talk of bioweapons. We know what Putin has done in terms of chemical assassinations, but love your take on all that.
Drew, the way this all started was in 1921 in Russia. Lenin and Stalin declared that they would outlaw the word God and that they would outlaw churches. Their problem was the Russian Orthodox Church. And so what they did is require all churches to turn in all their icons, to strip the dead literally in the cemeteries and turn it in. And then they charged the top 11 people nonetheless, supposedly with not having done it, and they sentenced them to death. Well, they walked out into the square around Easter time, March of 1922, and they were singing, "Jesus Christ is risen today." And the crowd of 7,000 or 8,000 in Moscow began answering, "Truly, he is risen." And of course, they shot them anyway. There were riots in Moscow, and they decided they had to come up with a way of eliminating people through poisons and all that appeared to be natural deaths. The first one that they eliminated was a man named Tikhon, the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church. He was like a big tree holding back the communists from hurting the Orthodox priest. They killed him, later proven beyond a doubt, using potassium to simulate a heart attack. As soon as he died, they killed in the following 2 years 175,000 priests in Russia. They executed them. They just disappeared. They continued to use poisons against Pavlova, but I thought because of your show it'd be particularly interesting to talk about Theodore Ramza, who is actually a Catholic saint in the Catholic Church. Ramza, in 1946, was sent by Pope Pius to Hungary. He belonged to a church called the Ruthenian Church. Unusual, they have Orthodox ritual, but they look to the Pope as their leader, and so they're a Catholic church. Well, at the age of 25, he got the unenviable job of being the bishop of the Ruthenian Church, the youngest bishop. Of course, by this time, the Soviets were ruling the Ukraine, where the Ruthenian Church was located, and they decided to absorb it into their state church in Russia, which by this time they controlled. Well, the Ramza wouldn't let this happen. They took away his car. They took away all the churches. And so Ramza declared at Easter time that he would meet with the flock in an open field. And out of the 300,000 people in Ruthenia, 200,000 of them showed in that open field, and none of them went to the official church. They then ran Ramza over with a car that looked like he was dying. He was being taken care of by some nuns. Two guys arrived from Moscow, a man named, they didn't know the name at the time, but his name was Maranovich, and a second guy, and they poisoned him with potassium, with Karari, actually causing his heart to stop. We know about that later on because Baranski confessed in 1956 that he did that, later that he did it at the orders of Khrushchev and Stalin, who signed the death warrant. So these folks have been using poison for a long, long time, none more than Putin, and over the last, 20 years.
Yeah, it's one of the weapons, I guess, in their arsenal, huh? And no doubt about it. I mean, you've seen with Vladimir Putin's invasion into Ukraine, a lot of pieces profiling the people that had surrounded him that ended up dead as well. The red line for the U.S., of course, is the use of bioweapons or chemical weapons. On a larger scale, outside of poisoning, do you think Russia, the Vladimir Putin, would go that far to use these bioweapons? Have they been used in Ukraine?
They've been used all over the world. He has a unit called Unit 5119, and there were two people, the Skeeples, who were poisoned in England. And they were the poisoners, Unit 1119, led by Colonel Chaval, were actually captured on a video camera. And so word went out, who are these people on the video camera? An idiot group of, not idiot group, but a group of bloggers actually found them on Facebook, exchanging congratulations on the killings. In effect, that they were doing, they were tracked back, and they killed at least 14 people using radioactive and other poisons in England alone. And other people, like the 2004 poisoning of the president of the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So they've been using bioweapons like anthrax and so on for individual killings for a long time.
Give us a little history on this. How far back does it go, and what are we seeing today, and what's the world doing to call it out?
In 1921, Stalin started, along with Lenin, Laboratory One. It expanded into a huge facility. They used human beings as test subjects to perfect the deal. Wow. Their object was always to create natural deaths. One of the leading executioners who later defected said any fool can murder someone, but it takes an artist to stage a natural death. And so they staged natural deaths, particularly in Paris and among white Russians and others all over the world from then on. Wallenberg, the great Wallenberg, who saved 100,000 plus people in Hungary from the Jews and was captured by the Soviets, was executed as a test subject in Laboratory One in 1947. So they've been doing it for a long time. A weapon of choice has been anthrax. It simulates, and it was used in the case of Pavlova to simulate pneumonia. If the bacteria gets into your lungs fill up with water, and they become infected, and you die in the absence of antibiotics, which didn't used to exist. And so they've been using biological weapons for a long time. They had a project called Enzyme, and Enzyme was they put more money into bioweapons in the Soviet era than they put into nuclear weapons. Wow. They had a huge facility at a place called Saratov. Hmm. And should I relate one story about Saratov?
Yeah, no, please go right ahead. I'd love to hear it.
In 1939, the head of Saratov, a man named Abram Berlin, and this was a story that took great courage to get out of Russia, but it's clearly true and acknowledged. Berlin was summoned to Moscow from Saratov to meet with Stalin. And so he arrived at the Hotel Nacional, Saratov 70 miles away. It still is a huge bioweapons facility. He arrived at the Hotel Nacional and he was coughing. And so they brought a doctor. The the night before he was supposed to meet with Stalin, and the doctor said, "My God, you've got pneumonic plague. We haven't seen pneumonic plague in 300 years in Russia."
Wow.
And this guy had been weaponizing pneumonic plague. Had they not discovered it, he would have wiped out the entire leadership of the Soviet Union the next morning.
Wow.
Well, because at that point there were no antibiotics, and pneumonic plague was inevitably fatal. It killed him and the doctor, and there were repeated leaks how the Soviet facilities, another one in Yekaterinburg in 1979, where they went out and shot dogs and pretended it was from tainted meat. It was actually anthrax leaking into the sanitary sewer system of Yekaterinburg. We know about this from a defector book called Biohazards, written by a guy named Albeck, who defected out of their program, was the number two guy in the 1990s. We have the same huge bioweapons facilities going on in China. And so it's a terrible curse for mankind. It's been used terribly, used often against Christians and Catholics.
Yeah. My guest today, John O'Neill, New York Times bestseller, wrote a new book that's out. It's called, I want to get it right. Is it the Zoning Out on Dancer and the Devil?
It's the Dancer and the Devil. It's for sale on Amazon. It's also at dancerandevil.com.
All right, dancerandthedevil.com. Check it out or check it out on Amazon. Let's talk China for a moment, too, while we can, because we know what Russia has done, not only historically across the 20th century, but as you pointed out, Vladimir Putin. China, is this part of their repertoire? I'm surprised to hear that. I'm assuming it is. And some people believe that even COVID-19 was a military biolab leak. And some people say, well, now it came from a wet market. China's use of this type of weaponry, what do we know? How far back does it go? And does COVID have anything to do with this?
Yeah, well, they have the largest bioweapons program on Earth. They have at least 14 different facilities that the U.S. has identified. Before COVID ever happened, the Pentagon said there'll be a leak out of these facilities. In 1977, in 1955, a flu appeared all over the earth. We all got it. You may remember it as a little boy. Well, in 1977, the impossible happened. A second flu appeared. That can happen, but it was exactly chemically identical to the 1955 flu.
Wow.
I have to explain, Drew, that flus mutate.
Right.
And so it's like John O'Neill in 1955 showing up in 2020.
Right.
It can't happen. But it did. It was exactly the same. And so people said somebody's preserved the 55 flu in a laboratory, and it's leaked. And the Chinese said, oh, we have no idea what you're talking about. Well, in 1994, the head of the virology program in China showed up, and he said, oh, yeah, the 77 flu, sorry. We were conducting vaccine tests with our army of the 55 flu, and it just got away from us.
Wow.
4 million people died on Earth from that. By the way, the virologist died within 2 years. He had a sudden heart attack with no history of coronary problems. So the Chinese laboratories have leaked repeatedly, as have the Russians. And they're always blamed on other things. At Yekaterinburg, the Russians claimed it was tainted meat, and they shot dogs and tried two butchers when it was really a leak into the sanitary sewer system of anthrax. And so it's a terrible curse, and it's used as a weapon. Putin brags that what he has is special weapons that make him superior to the West. He's done that in the presidential debate in 2012 and other times. When he singled out, he was asked one time to single out gave a speech on who the greatest heroes of Russia were. And he started by naming a man called Yasha as Russia's greatest hero. Yasha was famous as the poisoner in Paris. He's the guy that poisoned Pavlova. And not the women snipers, not Yuri Gagarin, the leader into space, not all the really great, brave Russians. They were not to Putin Russia's greatest hero. Russia's greatest hero was Yasha the poisoner. And that says a great deal about Putin. Putin's grandfather was the taster and cook for Stalin. Putin's father was an exterminator in the Ukraine. His job was to follow the Red Army and shoot people in the back of the head.
Wow.
And so that's who you're dealing with. And that, of course, is why the Ukraine is fighting so hard. They've seen these people before. You know, they have their own faith. They have their own country, and they don't want to be slaves again.
Yeah, no, I don't blame them. Back to China for a moment, because, I mean, it's a pretty big claim, and there's people on both sides of the aisle talking about the fact that COVID-19, which swept the world, how many lives has it taken? 10 million? Is it a military bioleak? I mean, what evidence do we have for that? And we've seen the multiple variations of this thing as it continues to mutate. What do you predict for the future of it? Is it over and behind us? And you know, what evidence we have in terms of its origins?
Well, the COVID virus is 96% the same as a virus that came from a bat, a horseshoe bat, located and found in a cave in the Himalayas in 2015 by people from the Wuhan Virology Lab. And they brought the bat. There's no other life form ever naturally located as close to COVID as that 96% in the horseshoe bat. They brought the bat to the lab at Wuhan, which they acknowledge, and they were doing what are called enhancement experiments with it. Now, the thing that most people don't know is the Wuhan Virology Lab has a brother lab called the military lab in Wuhan. Its job is to weaponize viruses and to weaponize bacteria. That's always been its job. It's a huge facility. So what happened? In 2019, on the doorstep of the lab, people began to get sick. A doctor learns that they're sick. He says, this new virus has appeared. It's never been seen anywhere else. They charge him with revealing state secrets. Mm. He supposedly dies a few days later, supposedly, of the COVID virus, although it kills less than 1.5% of the people his age. Mm-hmm. All the records are destroyed in China. They destroy them on purpose right then. The military troops, same guys, by the way, who crushed the students at Tiananmen Square, are moved into Wuhan. They take over, and everybody pretends first that there were no bats in the lab. And then second, we have no idea what you're talking about, or it came from the United States, or one story after another. The truth is, the only way you can explain what happened there is that it's from the bat in the Himalayas, and someone added and changed 4% of the DNA. And the way they changed it was using the CRISPR tool in the military lab to add a hook and make it more, you know, more contagious. And what are we going to do with it? Well, see, it's mutated now 5 times. It's not leaving, and it's not mutating in the way that any natural virus mutates. All natural viruses always become more communicable and less deadly. That's been the history of all of them. I mean, smallpox, every one. This virus is not following the same pattern, and it's mutating very, very quickly. And that's because it's the first virus that mankind's ever encountered that's not of natural origin. This is not a virus that comes from nature and was produced by evolution. This is an artificial virus. And so that's why there's such terrible difficulty in predicting where it's going to go, how to prevent it, and what to do with it. I'm sorry.
No, John, I'm fascinated by what you're saying. I'm just curious, how do these things get out of the lab? Accident? Well, deliberate? What do you think?
I think they were conducting vaccine tests to develop a vaccine. The most logical deal is that it happened exactly the same way as 1977. They had the virus. They developed it. Well, the virus by itself doesn't help. You have to have a vaccine, right, so that your guys don't get sick. And so you begin testing vaccines for the virus. And this is an unusual virus because you can have it and be asymptomatic. Yeah, all of a sudden, sure, you test a vaccine, you think a guy's asymptomatic, he goes out, he breathes on some other people, and it's out. And that's exactly what happened in 1977 in China. It happened several times, and that's very likely, my guess, what happened. Could have happened in other ways. I don't think they did it on purpose. I think they were developing it as a weapon, but they didn't mean to fire it when they did.
So is it possible to stop the development of bioweapons going forward? I'm assuming every nation has these, although the U.S. would say we don't. What do you know about that, and what can we do to make sure the world's a safer place?
In 1972, all the nations of the world, including China, Russia, North Korea, everybody signed the Biological Warfare Convention that banned the development of biological weapons. What happened in Russia is they immediately embarked on the greatest bioweapons development in history. Wow. I mean, they immediately started a huge development called Project Enzyme, outlined in Biohazard's book. They built islands that you could test bioweapons on, began manufacturing viruses and testing them in various ways. And so they completely, and in 2014, they banned all inspections of their bioweapons facilities, as did China. If we don't do something about it, this is a greater threat to mankind than nuclear weapons are. It really is, Drew. You can wipe out mankind with a breath, yeah. You know, with artificial diseases, because they hang around a long, long time.
That's really true. My guest today, John O'Neill, wrote a book called The Dancer and the Devil, Stalin, Pavlova, and the Road to the Great Pandemic. And it's available, of course, on Amazon. You can go to the website, too, The Dancer and the Devil. John, the book is just now hitting, right? Am I correct on that? Just now?
Yeah, it doesn't actually. You can order it right now on Amazon, or you can order it at our website, dancerandevil.com. Mm-hmm. It won't be delivered till April the 26th. That's when it actually becomes delivered. I need to say one more thing, Drew. Sure. I've underplayed how wonderful the people were that were killed by these guys. People like Father Ramza. I mean, this is a light in the world for all of us. Or these people, Tikhon or Pavlova, the great dancer who stood up, or Anna Akhmatova, who was a poet. There's a statue of her with a rosary on the River Neva in St. Petersburg, pointing right at Kresge Prison, where these were great, brave people. And in China, you know, a whole sequence without going through, many of them Christians, Wang Yi and Jimmy Lai, who all disappear and they're put in prison, or then they just die. And they're because they're afraid of them, because they can't deal with them, because communism is a fraud. It promises equality and ends up with people living, you know, like Putin in billion-plus-dollar houses, and the average man living a pretty bad life and very much a slave in many ways.
Yeah, that's so true. Well, John, thank you for writing it, and thanks for being here today. It's been great to talk with you. I think it's fascinating. I hope the book does incredibly well. It's very telling and very revealing, and it's a great read. So keep up your good work. Hopefully we can catch up again soon.
Thank you very much, Drew. I enjoyed very much being on your show to present The Fisherman's Tomb a couple of years ago.
I remember that. I actually replayed that interview several times.
It's going to be a movie. They're making a movie out of it now, and it was great. It generated a lot of money for Catholic Relief, and so it's a great story, of course. Anyway, thank you so much for that.
John, before I let you go here, when's that movie coming in? I'm curious, because that's such a great story. I love that.
Well, they've got they've raised all the money for it. What they're trying to do is cast it right now, and they're going to film it in Rome.
Wow.
And so they've got to cast it before they can film it. The delay has been occasioned because there's no box office. You know, almost all movies are going on to Netflix and stuff like that these days.
Yeah.
And so that has delayed the movie being made. And I always thought, of course, that the story of St. Peter actually being found down there was really important to people of faith, because it, you know, to me proves that Christ is not a Santa Claus story. You're dealing with a real person, a real God who gave his life for all of us, and people like Peter who gave their lives too.
Hey, John, I'll reach out to you. There is another approach to getting your film out, and I know there's been a number of, in fact, I know a director who released a film on Divine Mercy, went into theaters, a lot of different projects like that that might allow you to get it into theaters across the country. Just people have got to be aware of it, but I think it's a great story, the story of the finding of St. Peter, the first pope, of course, the fisherman. The book is great, and I replay that interview quite often on the anniversary of the discovery of that tomb. So it's always good to have you here with us. But I'll try to reach out,
and
I'll pass that info along, okay?
Sounds good. Thanks much, my friend.
Thanks, John. Good to talk. That's John O'Neill. All right, I've got to take a short break. I'll be back on the other side. If you are looking for a mortgage, 30-year fixed mortgage rate, climbed this past week over 5%. Can you believe that? Is a housing crash on the horizon? And can you use the word master bedroom anymore? We'll look at all that and more.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, thanks for joining me. Good to be with you. Hey, you getting ready to sell your house? Maybe put it up on the market. I was visiting a friend last weekend. I went into his neighborhood, beautiful neighborhood, right? And there was a house going for sale. I said, what's that going for? And I think the guy was asking, $654,000 for it, right? He says, yeah, he's asking $654,000, but he moved into it 10 months ago. You know what he bought it for? I said, no, what? He says, $525,000. And I don't think he did a whole lot to fix it up. I mean, that's a pretty big profit in about 10 months' time. But we're seeing it. I mean, there are these crazy bidding wars. I had a guy come over, an electrician, do a little bit of work in the house, and he says, oh, my wife and I were finally getting this house. We were moving. And he says, but you know, it's been crazy, Drew. He says, I had a bid. In fact, we lost the previous two homes. There were like 20 people bidding on the same house. We bid $25,000 over the asking price. And he said, we still didn't get the house. Two different times, $25,000 over the asking price. In fact, you know, one more story. I was talking to my colleague, John Harper, the other day. And he shared with me a story. I was sharing with him that story. And he said, oh, I got to tell you what happened with me. He lives in an area where the same things are happening. There was a woman who owned a home. I think the home in the area sold for $600,000 or something like that. A couple moved in, a beautiful little family. They did some work on it. They moved out. They sold it 10 months later for $700,000+. Somebody else came in and bought it. 4 months later, they moved. They sold it for over $800,000. We're seeing anywhere from $20,000 to $200,000 swings on some of these homes. But I wonder if it's going to slow down. Will the brakes be pumped? And we got this exuberant buying, multiple offers, there are bidding wars, and it's common. It's all across the country. And home prices in the nationwide year over year they just increased. And the question is the bubble going to pop? You know, will we see a boom bust cycle? I don't know. I don't know whether we're in a different time or not. I mean, as interest rates rise, I think that will slow things down. People can't get as much. But, you know, I thought we'd talk about it today. I thought we'd take a look at it. If you have a question regarding real estate, if you want to take a look at the market itself, and we could talk about everything too. You know, those love letters that people send out? I want to talk about that too, because Rhode Island, they're trying to propose a bill. I don't know if you heard this or not, that would ban those love letters from prospective home buyers. Sometimes that sells a home. You know, you write a letter to the home buyer and you tell them how much you love the home or how great it is or why you want to be here. And sometimes that motivates the buyer to go with you. In fact, I'm a guy full of stories, right? I'll share one last one and we'll talk about it. I worked with somebody, had a really big family, and they wrote to the owner of this home. The person was asking, you know, more money than they probably could afford for the home. And they wrote a beautiful letter to the person saying, hey, we've got all these kids and love your home. We'd love to live there. That person gave them that home. They didn't give it to them. They bought it at a much, much reduced price. So those letters can have a profound impact. But right now, it looks like, Rhode Island might be saying, hey, hold on. That's not going to happen. So, but here to talk a little bit about it, to answer your questions, to give us some perspective on this, is Wendy Wilmowski. She's been with me in the past. I always enjoy talking to her. She's been a real estate investor since, I think, 95, and a realtor since 04. And you can check her out at twocrownhome.com. That's her website. It's good to have her back. I spoke to her a couple months ago, and as the markets were still going pretty crazy, I thought we'd revisit it now as interest rates continue to climb. Wendy, it's good to have you back. Good afternoon.
Hey, thanks, Drew. It's always nice to be with you. Thank you.
So much to talk about, from, you know, love letters to homeowners to not calling the main, you know, bedroom in the home the master bedroom anymore, and a whole lot to talk about. But let's first talk about the market, because I think I can't, everywhere I turn, housing prices are continuing to go up. And there are mm-hmm. these wild bidding wars. When is it going to cool? I mean, I know interest rates have ticked up. Earlier in the week, I saw that they had gone over 5% for a 30-year fixed at one point. I think it might be less than that now. But where are interest rates, and what do you see looming for the not-too-distant future?
Well, I mean, there's two distinct schools of thought on this. But to answer your first question with regard to interest rates, they are right now, Freddie Mac put out today that their 30-year fixed averaged 4.72 this week, compared to 4.67 just last week. So 15-year is at 3.91. So we're seeing this uptick, and they're talking that they're going to be increasing, you know, the interest rates. The Federal Reserve is saying that they're going to raise them again with 6 more rate hikes through 2022.
And quarter percent or half percent, right? We don't even know how big those hikes are.
We don't even know how big those
right.
are going to be, no, but we just know that this is the first time that they've been raised since 2018. So that's going to directly impact mortgages, car loans, et cetera. Now, normally that leads to reduced demand because, you know, people can't afford at, you know, 5% what they could have afforded at 4 or 3.5% for the most part, especially, you know, if somebody doesn't have a lot of cash and they're staying within a relative equal, you know, they're selling their house for 350, they're going to buy a house for 350, right? Mm-hmm. So their debt to income ratios, et cetera. I'm not talking about those people that are selling in California and buying in a lesser market. You know, right. they continue to drive a lot of these higher prices that we're seeing. So, you know, CoreLogic, which is a real estate research company, has said, look, we don't expect that house prices are going to rise this year in 2022 to 2023 more than 3.5%. And they're saying that's because of rising interest rates, and it's going to affect the number of people that can afford to buy. However, you got the other side of the fence that's saying, hey, no, wait, look, you know, we have building for the first time since 2008 is booming. New construction starts jumped 6.8% in February, which is 22% higher than last year at this time.
Wow. Wow.
And that's the fastest growth that they've seen since 2006. Now, there's still issues with what we talked about last time I was on the show with new construction, right? So you've got the permit issues in many jurisdictions. You've got the lumber costs and a problem with enough workforce. But still, that will be something that will help fill in when people are getting overbid on existing homes, right? They can just go to a builder and the builder has a fixed price that they're going to pay and they know they're going to get that house. But the other data to consider is that, you know, you've got millennials that are now at a point where they're getting in 30 years old and they're looking to buy their first house. So,
is that the case? Well, let me ask you about that, because I was under the mindset that a lot of millennials, some of them have moved back home. A lot of them are renting. They don't seem to have this desire to buy homes, but maybe there is a tipping point. Maybe at 30 or higher, they're saying, hey, it's time to get a home. It makes sense to own. It makes sense to buy a home if you can certainly afford it. But where's that demographic? Because that's a pretty big number.
It is. And actually, those that were born between 1989 and 93, they're now right at that age where they want to start. Look, I have a 20-something-year-old niece who just bought a place. I have another niece that is 27, 28, and she would love to own.
Yeah.
So I think it just depends on, you know, where they're working, and, you know, that they didn't get a degree in underwater basket weaving, you know, and if they're making good money, you know, they want to own a place.
Right.
I work a lot and am in touch with a lot in this age group. And they're very savvy. I mean, you know, they're very technologically minded. So they're used to seeing things online and want, you know, instant answers and information. So
yeah,
I think they're going to be a strong. Yeah, sure. A lot are moved back home, but I still think that there's enough that it's causing this supply and demand issue. Along with the fact that, you know, sellers, where are they going to go, right? So there's a lot of sellers that have been on the fence because, you know, they don't see where they're going to go to buy something. So there's two things to that. One, there's now it's interesting because on the one hand, they're like getting nervous because they're saying, oh, things are going to slow because interest rates are going up. So I got to quickly put my house on the market. So we're seeing a little bit of an uptick in new listings. But then on the other hand, they're going, okay, but I have to do that so I can get top dollar, but then where am I going to go? And so I've noticed that there's some lending companies that have come to the table that are trying to fill that void where they're offering to help sellers in this situation be able to offer a cash offer so that they can, you know, win in a multi-bid situation. Those companies are increasing that I'm seeing come across my transom anyway with emails and whatnot. So
it's a great point, though, Wendy, because I have a relative who I said to him, I said, look, you know, you've been in this home for 20 years or however long it is. I said, you know how much it's worth? You know, you ought to sell it now. There'll be a bidding war on it. And he's like, but where am I going to go? To your point, I mean, people who see the, you know, the home selling like crazy for all this value, you still have to buy. And even new construction seems to be up, at least in my opinion, based on some of the numbers that I had looked at. It doesn't seem that cheap, you know, because that's always a great option, as you point out. So let me do this. I'm going to take a quick break. I'm going to open the phones, too. It's the final segment of the show coming up. If you want to join the conversation, we'd love to have you. The number here is 888-914-9149. Share your experience. Ask your question. We're speaking with Wendy Womalski today, a real estate investor and has been a realtor for a long time as well. Her fingers on the pulse of the housing market. We got a lot to talk about, too. We'll get into that Rhode Island bill banning love letters and how language is changing, the rooms you refer to, and more.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Get caught up on that conversation you missed by going to the Relevant Radio archives. Just select The Drew Mariani Show.
Hey, thanks for joining me. It's good to be here with you today. We'll grab a call or two. Just taking a look at the real estate market. The spring is upon us, and you know things slow down normally in, you know, late November, December. But boy, seems like houses are continuing to soar both in price and in sales. And if you're thinking about putting your home up, maybe you're thinking about buying or you got a loved one, you might want to turn up the radio. I'm joined today by somebody who's got a lot of expertise in this area. She'll take a take your calls and your questions and help answer your whatever question you might have. That's Wendy Womalski. She's been involved in real estate investing and served as a realtor for a long time. Wendy, let's go right to the phones. We'll grab a few calls here. Joanne is listening in Portland, Maine. Joanne, thanks for dialing in. Good afternoon.
Hi, Drew. I relocated to a bedroom town outside of Portland, Maine 16 years ago from San Diego. I had a townhome that I owned. It had property restrictions because of what you might remember, Proposition 13, which was passed in 1978. It mandated a property tax rate of 1% for properties, and you couldn't raise it more than 2% per year until the next sale. What's happening here in Maine, my father built this home 60 years ago. People around us are building $1-2 million homes. And they're coming, many of them are coming from California. So sky's the limit. And now the towns are reassessing property tax for all of us. And those homes are now bringing up the value of the community. And so it trickles down to people that have been here, you know, 50, 60, 70 years. It doesn't matter. You can be living in a very modest home and still be paying a huge property tax.
Now, what do you say?
I don't see...
I'm sorry, Joanne, you're in Portland, right? You're in Maine?
I'm outside of Portland. I'm 35 miles west toward the New Hampshire border.
I've got a couple.
We're on a lake.
I got a couple of friends that are in Maine, and they were telling me, and I go there every year and spend some time.
I know.
They were saying that there's a massive exodus, though, coming from New York. When the pandemic hit, a lot of people decided to get out, and the real estate there, I think there's more coastline in the state of Maine than there is up and down our western seaboard. I mean, believe it or not, because of all those, you know, inlets and areas that you have there, and it's stunningly beautiful. Maine is a gorgeous, gorgeous state. You're seeing people from California come there as well?
Right. I have a friend who's a builder. He has three clients from San Diego, and they're doctors and attorneys, and he is stunned at the price. You know, the price of lumber has tripled. Price is no problem to them. Whatever it is, Doug, no problem.
Yeah.
I mean, so he's amazed that he can build a home. He's still charging 1970 prices to build. But, you know, they have no problem spending $2 million. I mean, it's top of the line, everything.
Yeah, of course.
And I mean, our town is reassessing across the board. So lake property, you know, I'm paying over $8,000 a year in property taxes.
Wow.
I mean, it's 1,000 square foot, you know, one level, three quarter season home. And, you know, it's not luxury plus.
Right.
It's not Scarborough, Drew.
Yeah. You probably know my friend out there, too. That's so funny.
I do, and I know. Cindy, I know. Yeah, Cindy's a friend of mine.
Yeah, I was talking to her about the rising cost of taxes in that area there, too. I mean, it's crazy. Yeah,
right.
The cost of real estate in Maine is going through the roof, that's for sure. Wendy, jump into the conversation here, too. You know, it's a shame that what we're seeing in that state take place, but that's not the only state. I mean, we're seeing in states all along the U.S., especially on the seaboard. But go right ahead, and I'll let you respond.
Yeah, well, no, and I think it's a problem, and it goes back to, you know, there's consequences for who we elect into these offices. But, you know, a government is not going to stand by idle when they see that everybody else is cashing in and making all this money. They want their hand in it as well. We have a property in Delaware, and they're now reassessing everything in Delaware as well. And this was one of the retiree safe havens where, you know, you could have a house that was worth $600,000 and your, you know, property taxes were very reasonable, you know, under $1,500 for the year.
Right.
So, you know, we're seeing it across the country. And I also owned a house in Santa Monica, California, and I sold it before this whole Prop 13 went away, because it's really affecting the people, like you say, the retirees and the rest, who can't afford then to stay in their homes. And it's an injustice, I think.
Yeah, I don't know how people do it. I mean, you wonder where it's going to go. Joanne, my heart goes out to you. It really does. It's a shame that you've got to deal with that. But I know you're not alone. There's a lot of other people as well. And that's a tough situation, for sure. Thank you for calling. I appreciate you sounding off. And tell Cindy, if you see her, I said hello, if you don't mind, okay?
I will. And we hope appreciate to see you next summer.
Yeah, I'm coming back out. We're planning on it right now, so hopefully it'll be great. I love Maine. It's a beautiful state. Actually, I proposed to my wife in that state. You know, I've got a special place in my heart for it. I used to vacation there a lot, and I have friends who I travel to Maine with every year, and I've been doing it for the past couple of years, and stay in a little place called Christmas Cove. It's kind of cool. Sounds like something very Hallmarkish, you know? But if you're just joining us, Wendy Wilmowski is my guest, and I also have relatives in Delaware, and that's the state. I thought, if you want to move someplace, you go to Delaware, because real estate tax, you know, it's like non-existent. You know, it's so cheap. But honestly, it's changing everywhere. No matter where you go, we're seeing the rise of this.
No.
I want to get to another issue or two before we run out of time. And what's going on in Rhode Island? You know, you're a realtor. You know what happens. People, they love the home. They come into it. They're struck. They'll do anything to try to convince the buyer to sell it to them. Why is Rhode Island wanting to ban these love letters? And what's wrong with that? Why can't somebody say, hey, that's a beautiful family. Sure, I'll give it to them.
Well, you know, it's interesting because we were, I'm a member of the National Association of Realtors, and also a member of a lot of local boards, because I'm licensed in numerous states. And we had a directive that we should not, as listing agents, accept any love letters, because they're afraid that it's going to impact the sale of a house that could possibly infringe on the fair housing laws. Okay. So my broker won't allow us, for instance, to accept any letters just because of that. They just want it to be a level playing field based on the offer as it is, financing, no financing, however much, over asking, inspections, waived or not waived, et cetera, to look at it more in those concrete terms instead of getting all lovey-dovey.
That makes sense. That makes sense, but I don't know how I feel about it. I think of this couple with eight kids who wrote this letter explaining their situation, and they love the home, and the couple thought, yeah, I want to do something kind and charitable. I'll sell it a little bit less. I'm going to give it to them. I don't think they were in a bidding war with anybody else. They just wrote this letter to the person.
Mm-hmm.
I do understand how it can compromise you as a realtor. So I wonder if there's an end around, if you can just drop it in the mailbox or something, you know.
Hey, look, you know, if my buyers do something and they don't tell me, well, then I don't know, right?
There you go. Hey, Wendy, on another issue, too. I saw this story, and I don't know what the reason behind it is. It might be very innocent. You know, I often talk about the power of words and language. You know, we redefined, you know, abortion by calling it reproductive justice. You know, the Equality Act is out. It's really not about equality. You take a look at, you know, words, and we also see how mm-hmm. politically correct we're becoming. Like the Supreme Court justice
yep.
won't identify what a woman is. You know, it's just,
yep.
So now, you know, I saw a story, and I don't know a whole lot about it, but maybe you can give me some clarity on it, where we're not allowed to use the word master bedroom to describe the, you know, master bedroom in the main bedroom in the home, the master suite or whatever. Master is not the word you're allowed to use. I'm assuming it's reminiscent of something that deals with race or slavery, or what's going on there in the real estate industry that you can't use. I said can't, but it's not politically correct to use the word master anymore.
Well, you know, that changed back in 2020. And what happened was the Houston Association of Realtors decided on their own to, in their MLS system, to replace master bedroom and master bathroom with primary bedroom and primary bathroom. Well, what happens is there's an organization called the Real Estate Standards Organization that makes sure that search fields and all the MLSs across the country are using the same, you know, lockdown, you know, pull down menus, so that if you're doing a search, you can put in primary or master bedroom or whatever the term is, or second bedroom or kitchen, and it's all the same. So when Houston did that in June of 2020, the standards organization had to act quickly and make a decision, were they going to make this universal? And they decided to go ahead and make that change, even though in 1995, HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, reviewed it and said, you know what, it has nothing to do with slavery. It has nothing to do with a master slave situation. But I think it's what you said, you know, it's the direction that our country is going with regard to everything being PC. And so that is what you're seeing now. Across the board.
Yeah, and I don't have a problem with primary. It makes sense. That's a good term to use for the, you know, the main bedroom in the home like that, which is great. Wendy, it's always good to have you. You're such a natural.
Thank you.
I'm so grateful for your perspective on this. If people want to get in touch with you, I know you have a website, twocrownhome.com. I'm pulling that from memory. I believe that's what you said last time, right? Two Crown?
T-W-O. T-W-O. It's not the number two. It's T-W-O. crownhome.com. Yeah, and you know, a number of people reached out to me last time. I was happy to try and help all of them, actually. So feel free.
That's great. Wendy, thank you. I got to leave it there. I'm out of time
thank
for
you.
The day. Always good to have you here. It's Wendy Wilmowski. I've got Kel Clark's coming up, so stay tuned for him. He's right around the corner. I'll be back again tomorrow. Until then, I promise you I'll pray for you. Do the same for me. And we'll talk again soon. Have a great day.